Phony or not, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. The Washington Post reports that President Trump's being investigated for obstruction of justice. Trump calls it a phony story. We ask Post reporter Adam Entis where it's all headed.
I have no idea. This could take months, and it could take years. You know, I think it's really too soon to tell where this is going to go.
Plus, anger at the British government after a deadly fire in a high-rise apartment building.
Life didn't need to be lost, and they're lost, and people are looking for their children, and it's so unfair.
And Teju Cole's new book connects some unlikely dots between Nigeria and Switzerland.
In part, it's about how places are really much more deeply connected to each other than we might first think.
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. President Trump is calling it a phony story. But the ongoing Russia investigation only seems to grow more complicated by the day. First, the focus was on Russian efforts to influence last year's U.S. presidential election. Then it expanded to the potential collusion between Russian officials and the Trump campaign. Now, the latest twist. Reports that Special Counsel Robert Mueller is investigating President Trump for possible obstruction of justice. Adam Entis is a reporter with The Washington Post, which first broke the story. Adam, first of all, is it certain that Special Counsel Robert Mueller is looking into possible obstruction?
We've been told by our sources that he is looking into possible obstruction, that he's investigating that. That does not mean that he will decide to pursue it after he does interviews with officials. You know, obviously he has, in addition to talking to people like James Comey and other officials who had interactions with President Trump, he has documentation, including memos that were written by Comey, the former FBI director, as well as a memo that was written by the deputy head of the National Security Agency, who documented a phone call that President Trump had with Mike Rogers, the head of the NSA, in which the president, according to the memo, asked the NSA director to go out there publicly and refute that there was any evidence of any coordination between the Trump campaign and the Russians.
The Justice Department appointed Mueller after FBI Director James Comey was fired on May 9th. Who is Mueller's team questioning?
They are going to be questioning the most senior intelligence official in the government, Daniel Coates, who's the director of national intelligence. He's also going to be seeing Mike Rogers, the admiral, who's the head of the National Security Agency. And he'll be seeing Admiral Rogers' deputy, who's the one who wrote that memo at the NSA. We believe he's already had at least some conversations. We're not sure how in-depth with Comey. He has obtained Comey's memos, and he is, at least at this point, requested, I'm not sure if he's obtained, documentation at other intelligence agencies.
And what is Mueller and his team looking for?
At this point, you know, I think he's looking for information that would bolster the case that Comey made publicly and in his memos, that he believed that Trump had directed him to drop the investigation into Michael Flynn, who was President Trump's first national security advisor.
Are these interviews the next natural step in the investigation, or do you see it as a turning point?
Certainly, investigating the president himself is a turning point, since it's directly at odds with the assurances that Comey provided to then-President-elect Trump in January and then two other times after he became president. That said, I do think it's important for everyone to take a deep breath and to realize that we're probably at the beginning of a very lengthy process that will not be transparent to us. We might get slices of information as Mueller does additional interviews and as we find out about subpoenas and the like. But generally speaking, this process is opaque, and it's designed to be so in order to provide Mueller with basically the decision space to do his investigation and to try to figure out what the proper course of action should be.
What does this latest twist mean for the multiple Russia investigations?
I think what we're seeing by these interviews is that there's a prioritization that's taking place within the special counsel's office. They are front-loading this question of obstruction. That doesn't mean that they're not at the same time and down the road aggressively pursuing other avenues. One of the other avenues that we've learned about and reported on is investigating Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, and looking at his contacts with the Russians. A lot of people have tried to make the case, including the president, that this means that the collusion investigation is being abandoned. That's not what this means. What it means is that basically a new area of focus has opened up, prompted by Comey's firing.
Any idea how long this is going to take?
I have no idea. This could take a relatively short amount of period of time, months. If I was betting, I would say we're probably dealing anywhere from 1 year to 3 years. You know, I think it's really too soon to tell where this is going to go.
That's Washington Post reporter Adam Entis. Thanks, Adam.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Americans still have a lot of questions about Russia's meddling in our presidential election, but today it was Russians who got to ask away during a Q&A session with Russian President Vladimir Putin. It's an annual event in Russia. The Kremlin fields questions of all kinds during a televised call-in show. For more on this, we turn to the world's Charles Maines, who's based in Moscow. He says Putin once again denied that Russians had tried to influence the U.S. election.
But he implied that even if they had, it would be in response to American meddling the world over. In other words, that the U.S. had been involved with meddling in countries all over the globe and that Putin had always sort of solicited complaints from various world leaders who are too afraid of the United States to express that openly. But Russia, of course, is not. He was also asked about James Comey's testimony, which was an interesting moment. And let's hear what he has to say.
Второе. Он сказал, что он не видит, у него нет никаких доказательств о том, что мы вмешивались в подсчет.
So he's pointing out here that Comey said that he didn't have evidence of any Russian interference in the vote counting process in the U.S., saying, thank God that was the case, because at least that's something. But he goes on to note that Comey had recorded notes of his meeting with President Trump and leaked it to the press. And for Putin, this was very strange. He says, you know, essentially when a special services head records a conversation with the supreme commander and then passes it on to the media through a friend, this is not acting like the head of security services, but more like a human rights defender, someone like Edward Snowden. And then Putin appeared to, in any way, joke about offering political asylum if James Comey would face any political pressure at home. He could have asylum in Russia. I'm not so sure James Comey will take him up on it.
So Putin is sticking to the script. Meanwhile, here in the U.S., senators voted yesterday to impose new sanctions on Russia. It's punishment for meddling in the 2016 presidential election and a couple other things as well. Did the sanctions come up in the call-in show?
You know, they did. He said, as he said before, this is a result of political infighting in the U.S. But he also added that the sanctions were essentially a way for the West to try and keep sort of a rising Russia down. And this was a centuries-old tradition that was being implemented again as Russia is sort of gaining strength globally. But he did say that the two countries could work together on a host of issues. He noted, for example, preventing the spread of weapons of mass destruction. He noted Iran. He noted combating terrorism. And resolving the conflict in East Ukraine. So, you know, he said, like, we can work through problems, but, and most importantly, we don't see America as our enemy, but at the same time, he's saying America's our enemy.
I know this is a highly orchestrated event, but can we learn anything about what's on Russians' minds by listening to a call-in show with Vladimir Putin?
Well, you do in a way. I mean, it's as I've noted in the past, it's instructive theater. So there are these orchestrated moments that can be kind of ridiculous. For example, you know, they cut away to a correspondent in a far off place in Siberia, and suddenly he's surrounded by shamans, you know, who are singing in the background. And so, you know, you have these moments, but you also have a whole list of complaints. You know, Russia has this very vertical system of governance. It's all in Vladimir Putin's hands. There's almost no local governance on the local level in terms of deciding problems. So you see this kind of onslaught of complaints about housing, wages, healthcare, environment, trash pickup. I mean, it's all on Vladimir Putin's shoulders. Now, there were some kind of funny moments this year, particularly as they were soliciting not only video calls from people, but also text messages. And these were being displayed on the screen of national state television. And, you know, a lot of them would be complaints. But then suddenly you start to see these sort of odd trolling questions kind of come in saying, Putin, do you really think that the people believe in the circus with all these fake questions? Another one came in and said, all of Russia thinks you sat on your throne for too long. Another one brought up Alexei Navalny, the opposition leader, who's almost never mentioned on state television. Another one saying, you know, three terms is enough and goodbye, Mr. Putin. So these were kind of littered through the broadcast, which made it quite entertaining.
That was the world's Charles Maines in Moscow. At least 17 people were killed in that massive high-rise fire in London, but officials say the toll is certain to keep growing. Many of the tower's residents are still missing. Hundreds lived in the 24-story apartment block before the fire destroyed it. Now the pressure is growing on British Prime Minister Theresa May to provide some answers, and she's ordered a full investigation. The world's Leo Hornack was at the scene of the blaze yesterday and returned today.
This morning, in a way, the scene is kind of even more shocking. this tower. You have to imagine, Carol, it's 24 stories tall, so it's huge. And it's changed from looking like an ordinary housing block, 1970s housing block, to being a kind of, like I said, a blackened tooth on the skyline. The whole of the building, except for the bottom floors, is completely black and burnt. One of the things that is particularly sort of disturbing in a way is when you look up, you can actually see through bits of the building because everything except the concrete has melted or burnt away. And that means you can see bits of sky where windows used to be. You can actually see through parts of the building. It's affected not just the tower, it's affected, you know, the whole area. The place that I'm standing in right here, all around my feet there are these little kind of pebbles of burnt plastic about the size of a golf ball and smaller, which are from the tower. They've blown across the whole area and you pick them up and they kind of crumble in your fingers.
I've seen photos and it's just chilling because it really looks like it's from a war zone in a city that's been pummeled for months. But I'm wondering, how is the community around the Grenfell Tower coming to terms with this? Are Londoners out on the street there?
I'm just across the street from the main volunteer effort. People from the whole of Britain really have been donating clothes, food, water, and a huge effort is going on to try and organise that and distribute that to the families, because there were so many people living in this place who are now homeless. You know, those who are lucky enough to escape, they've lost everything. Those are the lucky ones. So there's that effort to help people, but there's also the other side, which is the mourning going on, and a whole wall on one of the nearby housing blocks at sidewalk level has been turned into a memorial wall. And you can see people writing messages. Some of the messages are very general, you know, our hearts are with those people who have gone. But some of them are much more personal and refer to actual individuals who lived in the block. I saw just an 8-year-old schoolboy who was writing a message to one of his school friends who he hasn't seen and no one knows where he is, who lived in the block. And he was just writing on that wall on his own with a felt tip pen, "Our hearts are with you," and the name of his friend. Oh. And it's when you see things like that, Carol, that it really brings home that this is affecting people on an incredibly personal and intimate level at this time.
I was going to ask you, I mean, what about the many Tower Block residents who are still missing?
That's the real horror of this, is that there's a huge question mark as to what happened to many of the people who were in this block. One person spoke to one of my BBC colleagues. Her name's Nicola, and she's someone who is deeply, deeply worried about a friend of hers who lived in one of the upper stories. Here's what she told them.
She got separated from her mum in the panic in the early hours of the morning. And obviously, as you can imagine, as a mother, she's frantic. She was told that she was at hospital. She went to hospital only to find it was the same name but wrong girl. And we are angry. I'm not going to lie, the locals are angry. This could have been prevented. Life didn't need to be lost. And they're lost and people are looking for their children and it's so unfair.
Oh, it's just devastating to listen to that. I mean, it really sounds like the locals are really hurting and demanding answers. What will happen next in the aftermath of this tragedy?
You heard the emotion in that woman's voice, and that's what's all around me right now, that people who feel, you know, just as desperate and angry and in as much pain as that. But in a wider sense, a lot of the political attention is now turning to exactly what went wrong that allowed this blaze to happen.
The World's Leo Hornack outside what remains of the 24-story Grenfell Tower block in London. Thanks, Leo.
Thank you, Carol.
Why a resolution condemning racism caused chaos at the Southern Baptist Convention. That's just ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. The Southern Baptist Convention was in the spotlight this week when it took up the issue of racism at its annual meeting. It started with a resolution written by a Black Baptist pastor from Texas. He wanted the Southern Baptists to officially denounce white nationalism and the so-called alt-right movement. At first, his resolution was ignored. But after much drama, the convention did overwhelmingly vote to denounce every form of racism, including white supremacy. Emma Green writes about religion for The Atlantic magazine. Emma, before we get into the details of this story, remind us, who are the Southern Baptists? I know it's one of the largest Christian denominations in the country, isn't it?
They are the largest Protestant denomination and second to Roman Catholics as the largest Christian population in the United States. And they have churches and members all over the country. They tend to be conservative, evangelical Protestant Christians.
And what about the racial makeup in the pews among Southern Baptists today?
There's a significant portion of Southern Baptists who are African American or other racial minorities, and a number of Southern Baptist churches are mixed. Although the different traditions within the Southern Baptist Convention of African American worship and white worship tend to lead congregations to sometimes stay separate, there have been many efforts in the past couple of years in particular to try to merge congregations or get conversations happening between populations in the Southern Baptist Convention of different racial makeups.
Now, tell us a little about this pastor from Texas. His name is Dwight McKissick. What was he trying to do with this resolution at the Southern Baptist Convention?
McKissick has always been a leader on racial issues within the Southern Baptist Convention and has tried to push these issues to the fore. He leads a large congregation in Arlington, Texas, and he, with this resolution, was trying to get the convention to take on the alt-right and white supremacy head first. This was an effort by McKissick to make the convention make a clear statement about what they believe about white supremacy.
And he himself is African American. What did the resolution say?
The resolution focused in very strong language on the alt-right movement that has emerged in the last few years in American politics, and particularly around the last election. It talked about the retrograde ideologies, xenophobic biases, and racial bigotries of the so-called alt-right, and called on the Southern Baptist Convention to condemn nationalism, to condemn white supremacy, and condemn that alt-right movement.
Now, condemning the alt-right and white nationalism, it seems like a no-brainer. Why was this resolution held up at first?
The resolutions committee thought that the proposal was not written in quite the right way, and so they decided not to report it out. McKissick even tried to get reconsideration. He made a motion on the floor to get a two-thirds vote to have more time allotted for his resolution to be considered. But ultimately, that failed as well, and this started a total tailspin of chaos when it looked like the Southern Baptist Convention had declined to consider this resolution condemning the alt-right.
How is it resolved? In the end, they have come out against them.
At a late night meeting, they gathered and finally decided to suspend the rules to make an exception, which generally these conventions are very procedurally driven. They broke those rules, though, in order to be able to the next day reconsider a newly drafted proposal which mirrored a lot of McKissick's language. And on Wednesday afternoon, they in fact voted almost unanimously in favor of this condemnation of the alt-right.
Now, in the end, was it seen as kind of a procedural, kind of at the end of the day and we're all tired, kind of oversight? Or does it tap into kind of raw nerves within Southern Baptists in terms of ambivalence about the alt-right?
Certainly the leaders of the convention tried to explain this as mostly a procedural mishap or something that had been caused by confusion. But a number of people pointed out that this reveals the blind spots that can sometimes happen within Southern Baptist life, and particularly within its leadership ranks, when there aren't people of diverse backgrounds who are making decisions. And there was a lot of emotion. This really revealed fracture lines within the Southern Baptist Convention over racial divisions that are going to continue beyond any resolution.
I mean, the Southern Baptists have a kind of tough history regarding slavery. Tell us about that, and specifically this concept of the curse of Ham.
The Southern Baptist Convention is a denomination that was explicitly founded to support slavery. It split off from other Baptist denominations because the leaders of the nascent movement wanted to be able to hold slaves. And the denomination has been wrestling with that history ever since the Civil War. They have made apologies for their role in upholding notions of racial supremacy, especially during the Jim Crow period. And this is where theories like the Curse of Ham come into play. This is an interpretation of the Bible, which says that African Americans or dark-skinned people are inferior to white-skinned people. It was used as justification for slaveholding and also used as justification for segregation. This has now been repudiated, but what McKissick was trying to do with his resolution was get the Southern Baptist Convention to apologize for that theory head on.
And in the end, does the resolution they came up with, does it come in the form of an apology?
It's not exactly an apology, but it is a straightforward acknowledgement of the Southern Baptist Convention's history and also the progress that it's trying to make for the future. It doesn't, for example, mention the curse of Ham by name, which is something that McKissick wished it had done, but it does speak in very frank terms about the need for racial justice and reconciliation among Southern Baptists. The resolution tried to be more hopeful in the revised version. It talked about the resolution, for example, condemning the Confederate flag that happened in 2016, or a previous resolution in 2015 that had called for racial reconciliation. Ultimately, this resolution is one step in a long trajectory that the Southern Baptist Convention has had in trying to take on racism and issues of racial division.
Emma Green writes about religion for The Atlantic magazine. Thanks, Emma.
Thank you.
One more story before the break. We recently listened to a speech by Arnold Chan. He's a Canadian member of Parliament, and he's been fighting cancer for more than 2 years now. Earlier this week, he addressed Canada's House of Commons. He thanked his wife and then had a pointed message for his colleagues.
I'm not sure how many more times I will have the strength to get up and do a 20-minute speech in this place. But the point I want to impart upon all of us, I know that we are all honorable members. I know you revere this place. I would beg us to not only act as honorable members, but to treat this institution honorably. And so the other thing I would simply ask all of you, ask all of our colleagues, Mr. Speaker, to consider, while we debate and engage, what we're doing right now, when we listen to one another, despite our strong differences, that's when democracy really happens. That's the challenge that's going on around the world right now. No one's listening. Everyone's just talking at one another. We have to listen to each other. And in so doing, we make this place a stronger place.
Seems like good advice for politicians on both sides of the border right now. That was lawmaker Arnold Chan addressing the Canadian Parliament in Ottawa earlier this week. Thanks to our friends at the CBC for that recording.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills. The U.S. is deporting Iraqis, like this man who was born in Iraq but raised in the U.S.
I was shackled. I was handcuffed all the way till I landed in Baghdad.
1,400 Iraqis are now facing deportation. Their story, plus author Teju Cole on what connects us to people around the globe. That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The Iraqi-American community in Michigan is on edge this week. In recent days, dozens of Iraqi immigrants have been arrested in the state. Stunned families protested near Detroit as the men boarded a bus headed for a detention center. The World's Shirin Jafari has been following this story, and she joins me in the studio. Shirin, what's going on?
To understand what's happening in Michigan, you have to take a step back and take a look at what happened a couple of months ago. Remember that there was a travel ban that President Trump issued back in February? It listed seven countries: Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, Sudan, Yemen, and Iraq. And for 90 days, people from these countries would not be able to enter the U.S. And then after that, they would have more screening. Then comes March 6th, and President Trump issues a second revised travel ban.
Because, of course, the courts were not going with that first one.
Exactly. And then in the second version, Iraq was taken off the list.
You know, at the time, I assumed that was because Iraq had been an ally and we'd shed so much blood and treasure and we should respect them, et cetera, et cetera. But it turns out there's more to it.
Yeah, that is part of it. But what actually happened, it turns out, there was a deal that was struck between the U.S. government and the Iraqi government. We don't know a lot about what happened behind closed doors and how this deal came about. But what we do know is that part of this deal is that Iraq is going to accept Iraqi Americans that the U.S. wants to deport.
Well, couldn't the U.S. deport Iraqis before who had issues for deportation?
It wasn't as straightforward. Many of the Iraqis who live here in the U.S., they don't have documents that show they're Iraqis. They left Iraq many, many years ago, many of them. They left as war was going on. They haven't been back for years and years. So they don't have Iraqi documents. And the Iraq government would say, we don't even know if these people that you want to deport are in fact Iraqis. With this deal, Iraq says, okay, fine, take us off the list. We'll take them back, even if they don't have Iraqi documents.
So this new deal happens between the Trump administration and Iraq, and now the U.S. government is deporting Iraqis.
Exactly. Iraqis who have been living here, some of them for 30 years, 20 years. And this is basically a human fallout of a political situation.
I know during the Obama administration, they started deporting Iraqis. What happened then?
Yeah, a group of Iraqis were deported back in the Obama administration. But there was a lot of uproar from the activists, from lawyers, and it basically stopped. But now it's picking up again.
So who are the kinds of Iraqis who are being deported right now back to Iraq?
There are about 1,400 Iraqis who face deportation. And these are people who have final court orders to be deported. Some of them have committed crimes. And initially, the thinking was that immigration officials would only go after the worst of the worst, violent criminals, rapists, murderers. But now what I'm hearing from lawyers is that they're going after people who have been convicted of marijuana possession or cocaine possession. Some of these people have served their time. They're out, you know, they're business people. They have families. They're average taxpaying people.
Now, it sounds an awful lot like what's happening with the deportation of young Central Americans. Are there similarities?
There are a lot of similarities. I mean, Iraq is a war zone, and a lot of these Central American people who are being sent back, they also face violence, criminal gangs, you know, all sorts of violent criminal action going on in Central America as well.
Okay, Shirin, now I understand you have two stories from your recent trip to Michigan. Let's hear the first part.
It was dark, 2 a.m., on April 19th, when a small plane took off from Alexandria, Louisiana. On it were 8 Iraqis. Riad Jabou was one of them.
I was shackled. I was handcuffed all the way until I landed in Baghdad.
Jabou is one of about 1,400 Iraqis caught up in the deal struck between the U.S. and Iraq. His Christian belongs to a minority group called the Chaldeans. Many of them fled Iraq because of persecution and mistreatment under Saddam Hussein. Things are even worse for them now with the Islamic State. Jabou has lived in the U.S. for nearly 30 years. He doesn't speak Arabic, doesn't know anyone in Iraq.
Well, when I got to Baghdad, I was very scared. I was very, very scared.
At the airport in Baghdad, he was handed over to an Iraqi general. Jabou says he couldn't contact his family for 3 days. Eventually, he asked the Iraqi general if he could use his phone to call his mom in the U.S.
When he heard my mom and my sister, you know, yelling and crying, the guy automatically started crying.
Jabou says the Iraqi general worried about his safety, and he had reason to. Jabou was flown to an area near Mosul, where the fight between the Islamic State and coalition forces is full on. It was the only place he knew someone, a friend of a friend. But Jabou worries about being a kidnapping target.
I know 1,000,000% I would be kidnapped and killed. To them, I'm an American and I'm a Christian, born in Iraq but raised in America.
Jabou came to the U.S. when he was 22. He met an Iraqi woman, a U.S. citizen, and they got married. But he lost his green card and his legal status after a marijuana possession charge. So no violent criminal, like other Iraqis detained recently by U.S. immigration agents.
I'm not no rapist, I'm not no murderer, I'm not no criminal.
Jabou spent almost a year in detention centers. With no end in sight, he agreed to be deported on April 19th.
What do you want me to do in jail, ma'am? Can some of these motherfuckers
go and stay in jail one night and see how what it looks like being in jail.
If Jabu uses strong language, it's because he feels betrayed. While he was deported to a war zone in Iraq, his daughter, a U.S. Marine, is serving in Japan. Jabu himself helped the U.S. military in Iraq in 2009. He won't say what he did exactly, just that it's work that makes him fear for his life in Iraq. Back in the U.S., Jabu has made a life for himself in Michigan. He started a business called Raised Trucking Express outside Detroit. Tractor trailers drive in and out of the lot of a busy highway, kicking up dust.
Hi, Sam. How are you?
Sam Dawood is running the business now while Jabu is in Iraq. He's also Iraqi Christian and one of Jabu's close friends.
I do all the deposits for his business. His mom is helping me collecting rents, and I do all the financial, make all the payments.
Dawood says Jabu's business is losing money without him around. He's usually in the office 12 hours a day, he says. Jabu's mom, Juliette Kasyonan, shakes her head. Her eyes are red and puffy. I ask her why. She struggles with English, so Dawood translates.
Her heart is crying.
Kasyonan says she contacts her son every day on WhatsApp.
Hello.
Hello, hi, Raid. How are you, Habibi?
Jabu says things are the same. He's at a friend's house, calling people in the U.S., seeing who can help him. When he's not making phone calls, he just sits around. Going back to the States won't be easy, or traveling anywhere else, really. He doesn't have any ID. If he does manage to travel, where would he go?
Where do you think I'm going to go? Wherever God's going to take me, man. Honestly, I have no idea. I was thinking if Canada can accept me, I mean, I can be close to my family, because all my family are U.S. citizens. All my family are in the United States.
An immigration official said in an email that all of the Iraqis put on the April flight to Baghdad were removed consistent with the judge's order. The official said he wouldn't discuss individual cases or confirm when the next flight to Baghdad is going to be. For The World, Shirin Jafari, Warren, Michigan.
Tomorrow, Shirin will bring us the story of another Michigan man facing deportation to Iraq.
Every single day is a challenge, because you just don't know when you're going to pick up.
Tune in tomorrow to hear the full story. In the small city of Prostějov in the Czech Republic, researchers want to restore a Jewish cemetery that was destroyed during the Nazi occupation, but they've run into some fierce local opposition. My BBC colleague Rob Cameron, who's based in Prague, reported the story.
Well, when you walk around Prostějov, there are certainly traces of what was once a very, very vibrant Jewish community. You can see a large building that was once the main synagogue. Opposite that is another very large building, again another big synagogue. All that has gone. Those buildings are now churches. One of them is now part of the town hall where you go to pay your parking fines. But a short distance from the city centre, you come across a very modest, very well-maintained city park, crisscrossed with paths, and it's also really a kind of access route to a very large school. So when you walk around there, all you see are people pushing prams and children going to school or coming out of school. But this was once the old Jewish cemetery of Prostějov, where the remains of almost 2,000 people still lie underneath.
I know there's a man, Tomas Jelinek, who used to be head of Prague's Jewish community. You write that he has a mission. What is it?
Well, he is trying to recover the tombstones that were once featured in this graveyard. What happened was that the city's ethnic German mayor in 1943, the year after Prostějov's Jewish community had been deported and sent to the death camps, he bought the space from the Reich authorities, and the cemetery was razed. The tombstones were broken up. The more valuable ones apparently were sold off, and the less valuable ones were just sort of handed out as building material to people in Prostějov and the villages around it. And what Tomáš Jelinek is trying to do is recover those lost gravestones.
And is he a resident of Prostějov?
He's not. He's from Prague, and he basically makes this journey every few weeks and months when people contact him to say, look, my backyard is paved with Jewish tombstones, or people find them in cellars and propping up chicken coops and just lying around in their gardens. So he's going through this very, very painstakingly slow process of responding to these calls and emails and then trying to recover the stones.
But you report that he's being met with very strong local opposition. Why?
Well, he basically represents an American foundation which is funded by a rabbi, I believe, in New York. And what they want to do is simply to rehabilitate, I suppose is the right word, this little park, not to restore it as a functioning cemetery or to bring all the stones back and try and recreate it, not at all. All they say is, it's a place of remembrance for us. These kids are walking to school over the bodies of almost 2,000 people. All we want to do is somehow demarcate it and perhaps put some of the stones that we've recovered, because they haven't recovered many, only about 36, back in one corner of the cemetery. But there's been a huge, huge chorus of disapproval.
What's behind the disapproval?
Essentially, there have been a number of campaigns suggesting that the Jewish community, you know, American Jews, American rabbis wanted to come in and wall off the entire park and prevent access to the school and build a brick wall around what was once the cemetery, etc., etc. None of which is true. In the end, 3,000 local people signed a petition against this plan, and the town council just got cold feet, and they said, actually, no, we're putting this whole project on hold. Until then, they had been vaguely supportive. But as soon as that happened, as soon as they realized the depth of the local opposition, however misinformed it was, they got cold feet and decided, no, you know what, we'd rather not get involved.
The thing I'm puzzled about is that all around Eastern Europe, there are programs to rebuild Jewish cemeteries that were vandalized during the war. I mean, you can visit cemeteries in Poland, Ukraine, Serbia. Do you find the Czech Republic kind of different and less inclined to celebrate its Jewish history?
Absolutely not. No, I would say quite the opposite, actually. I think that in general, the Czech Republic is one of the least anti-Semitic countries in this region. And certainly big cities, Prague, Brno, Mikulov, Olomouc, Ostrava, certainly go to great lengths to celebrate the country's Jewish past. But what I would say, I think what's happening in Prostějov is not so much the fact that it's Prostějov, I think it's more a signal of the general rise of something quite disturbing in this whole region, where you do see some rather sort of unreconstructed attitudes emerging again. There is certainly a very sort of provincial and xenophobic tinge to some of the debate that is being had in this part of the world, especially in this country. I think the local people are as hostile to Muslim refugees as they are to rabbis from New York. It's just the general zeitgeist, I think, that's really at the heart of this.
The BBC's Rob Cameron in Prague. He was telling us about efforts in the Czech Republic to restore a small Jewish cemetery that was destroyed by the Nazis. Tomorrow on The World, we travel to the Greek city of Thessaloniki. Jews lived there for 2,000 years. And as in the Czech Republic, World War II nearly erased Jewish history there. In the case of Thessaloniki, it was a massive Jewish graveyard that contained hundreds of thousands of graves. After the Nazis came, the cemetery was destroyed, the stones used for building materials. And now they're scattered all over the city. We sent a reporter there to see.
You can find fragments of headstones all over the city. They're embedded in churches, buildings, even sidewalks. But taking one of these stones is illegal because they're considered historical property.
Most of the times I simply record and photograph them because they're embedded in pavements, they're embedded in walls, they're embedded in stairs.
Rescuing the gravestones of Thessaloniki's Jews. That's on the show tomorrow. Nigerian-American author Teju Cole wants us to rethink what it means to travel around the globe. So Cole, who's a novelist, photographer, and art historian, has put together a new book. It's called Blind Spot.
In part, it's about how places are really much more deeply connected to each other than we might first think.
Cole's book takes the reader to 25 different countries. He juxtaposes photographs with brief essays, finding connections that might easily be overlooked.
If we think about a place like Lagos and compare it to a place like Zurich, we think there must be polar opposites in every respect, but that's not the case. I think there's a line that connects almost everywhere in the world. I'm very interested in claiming normalcy for all the places I've been to, especially places maybe that are not always thought of as, you know, completely normal. You know, we think that, for example, African countries or Asian countries are like all drama and all tension and all conflict all the time. And I'm always eager to show that, well, you know, they have street signs and kids go to school and the interiors of homes look much the same as they do in the U.S. or in Scandinavia or New Zealand.
Well, it's interesting because this collection, it takes us to 25 different countries. But in some respects, just as you're saying, it seems like we're never really in one place, but at the same time, we're always in the same place. I'm wondering if you can read us what you wrote next to the photo on page 52. It's entitled Lugano, a city in the Italian part of Switzerland.
Lugano, she said to me, Europe is getting worse. I still don't understand why you want to move to Switzerland. I said to her, I don't want to move to Switzerland. Quite the contrary. I like to visit Switzerland. When I'm not there, I long for it. But what I long for is the feeling of being an outsider there. And soon after, the feeling of leaving again, so I can continue to long for it.
How do you understand that feeling of dislocation? Is it something specific to the time we're living in? It's kind of a mobile time. It's fast. It's digital. We're kind of, you can move around without even leaving.
That's definitely the case. But for me, it's also highly specific, highly personal. I'm from two different countries. I grew up in Nigeria. I've lived in the U.S. for even longer than I lived in Nigeria. I have citizenship in both places. But because of this divided experience of two countries, I'm not 100% at home in either of them. So that's already the backdrop to my traveling. And now I've become somebody who travels a lot. So not only am I displaced when I'm, quote, at home, then I'm doubly displaced when I travel. But I see this as, yes, it is a common experience in the world now. But in my case, it's also something to embrace, because then it means that you can look at places with both a skeptical and a generous eye.
I wanted to go to the passage you wrote that accompanies the photo, Wannsee, which is in Berlin.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Wannsee. I wrote to her, the house is nice, but Kleist shot himself about 100 yards from here. She wrote back, within 100 yards of anywhere, someone shot himself.
Now, Kleist is a German poet who died in 1811. What's the relationship here, or is there anyone, between what you wrote and the image you include?
So the image we're looking at is of a convertible. The top is down, and it's a close-up shot of the car showing the seats and then the retracted roof. And somehow interrupting this entire field is some kind of complicated tree branch, almost as if a tree has fallen across the open top of this convertible. It's a very strange image, and I can't quite explain it. What this pairing allows me to do is to bring two different kinds of strangeness together, and that's very much my technique in this book.
Are you also trying to say something about how violent acts live on in certain ways?
Absolutely. I mean, I've always believed that places continue to retain some charge from the things that happen in them. When I look at this on a really massive scale, it means that living in New York City, every time I pass by the World Trade Center, I am, of course, reminded of the horrible event that happened there. The place, it's not just where it happened, it kind of retains the horror of that day. But I'm also attuned to the way that this happens in much more innocent-seeming places. So very much in this book, it's either I'm digging into a particular location to find out what might be vibrating on some other level in that space, or I don't quite find out exactly what happened there, but I assume that there must have been something that happened. After all, most of the cities we inhabit have been around for hundreds of years, and they certainly contain the lives of all the people who lived in them before we did. Especially the people who built those cities for their own use. And now we've sort of taken over and we live in their houses and walk on their streets.
What strikes me when I read this book and look at the photos is that you're less interested in the place per se and more in what's being lived there, what's happened there.
That's right. I mean, a place can easily be reduced to its cliches, and France can become the Eiffel Tower, Rome can become the Colosseum. But the reality is that these are places where people live and have ordinary human emotions and have the burden of history of them on them. And it's not about what country you're in, or your race or your religion. It's about the fact that each human life is made up of its own interaction with the past in very interesting, but again, rather continuous ways.
Teju Cole's new book is called Blind Spot. Teju Cole, thanks for speaking with us.
Pleasure to speak with you, Carol. Thanks a lot.
Finally today, some news that's way overdue. Last night, the National Music Publishers Association honored John Lennon's Imagine with its Centennial Song Award.
Imagine there's no country. It isn't hard to do.
Lennon's 84-year-old widow, Yoko Ono, was there, and the NMPA honored her by announcing plans to add Ono's name to Lennon's as co-writer of the song. When Imagine came out in 1971, Lennon only listed himself as author. But in this December 1980 interview with the BBC, just 2 days before he was murdered, Lennon tried to set the record straight.
Actually, that should be credited as a Lennon-Ono song, mm-hmm. because a lot of it, mm-hmm. the lyric and the concept came from Yoko. But those days, I was a bit more selfish, a bit more macho, and I sort of omitted to mention her contribution. But it was right out of Grapefruit, her book. There's a whole pile of pieces about Imagine this and Imagine that, and give her credit now, long overdue.
It only took 37 more years, but Yoko, congratulations. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Carol Hills. Back tomorrow.
You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us, and the world will live as one.
PRI, Public Radio International.